Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. Trading through big macro events in the 1990s, Mike Novogratz is no stranger to market instability and the central bank response that is ultimately required to restore order. Our conversation is a retrospective on the long period when firmly positive interest rates were a thing and when market prices were discovered through supply and demand. In Mike's rendering, today's world looks a lot different. Central banks have taken an increasingly activist role in guiding interest rate markets and preventing unwind events from becoming self-reinforcing. The result, stable prices in some asset markets, but increasingly speculative characteristics in plain sight in others. Our conversation covers a lot of ground, and Mike has much to say about bonds, bubbles, Bitcoin, and even bail. About the latter, he has founded the Bail Project, a passionate effort focused on creating a more humane pre-trial bail system. Lastly, we discuss Mike's founding of Galaxy Digital Holdings and his investments in various aspects of the crypto value chain. On Bitcoin, he says both simply and emphatically, we value it because we say it's valuable. And in a world where money printing has accelerated, Bitcoin may still be in the early innings of a tail outcome resulting from the change that has been thrust upon us all. I hope you enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with Mike Novogratz. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Mike Novogratz. He is the founder of Galaxy Digital Holdings and also a founding partner of Fortress and a partner at Goldman Sachs from back in the day. Mike, thanks for taking the time to be a guest on the Alpha Exchange.
I'm pretty excited.
Well, you got your career started in the early 90s in definitely a very, very different environment for markets. There were interest rates back then, but there was a lot of FX vol, not so much these days, but in the 90s, we had a series of events, Soros and the Bank of England, the tequila crisis, Asian contagion in the late 90s. Tell us about your early days in macro. You traded through some very, very big events. What were the early days like for you in terms of finding and trading through these big macro events?
Sure. So it started actually as a salesman in the money markets. And I remember rates were 8% on the way down, selling 30-day commercial paper and treasury bills. And I remember the sterling crises and then the Swedish krona exploded. Back then, you had great interest rate volatility because you had great currency volatility because we had great interest rate volatility. I mean, the simple models that a lot of people use were just interest rate differentials. And what was the first derivative and the second derivative? What direction were things heading and were they heading at an accelerating or a decelerating fashion? And so in some ways, trading was a little easier. It was also easier because every time you had interventionist central banks like the Swedish peg or the Bank of England, later on in Asia with the Thai baht basket, the Indonesian rupiah peg, you had giant players on one side that were inefficient and market forces on the other. And it was really before the time of the giant mega sovereign wealth funds. So one of the things the sovereign wealth funds have done is in a bizarre way, they've quelched volatility. They're bigger. Soros used to be the biggest player in the market by tenfold. And now he's a peanut next to Bank of China or some of these other big sovereign wealth funds. And so the power structure shifted a little bit. And so currency trading is not nearly as fun as it used to be.
You make a really interesting point there just around the changing of the guard in terms of whether it's private capital or now maybe it's public capital that's pooled towards, in some ways, maintaining stability in the system.
Yeah, you look at the fixed income market today. I was showing my son, he's taking a trading seminar with me this summer because there's nothing else for a teenager to do. And I was showing him the 30-year bond price over the last 4 months. And you're basically in the future pegged at 180. And he's like, well, how can that be? I said, because the government buys it every day. And when it goes down, people front run the government. And so it's taken a lot of the profit opportunity out of the market for investors and traders. In the long run, it's an unstable equilibrium. There's no way that ends well. 30-year rates at $1.30 when the Fed just is in the process of saying we're going to try to get inflation over 2% and we're printing money hand over fist makes absolutely no fundamental sense. You have a government printing money to the government. And so Ponzi schemes never end well.
Yeah, some folks say that risk can't be created or destroyed. It only kind of changes form. And I'm just wondering if you go back, let's just say to the Asian crisis in 97, it doesn't seem like that sort of end result is really the type of thing that folks would even allow to happen these times. The central banks are empowered to just do whatever to squelch risk.
The thing about the Asian crises that we learned was that when leverage gets built up in a giant way and it unwinds, if it gets beyond the first fire break, it unwinds at a pace that it wants to. And so you have this fantastic deleveraging, ugly, brutal deleveraging that destroys value and way overdoes things. And so if you look at the Indonesian rupiah, there were tons and tons of Japanese banks that had lent to Indonesian corporates against that dollar peg. So everyone had borrowed in dollars. And when all of a sudden their local currency started depreciating, they had to pay much more expensive dollars back and they couldn't do it. They had these huge wipeouts. Often the banks took the brunt of the losses. Banks then get recapitalized by their home sovereign central banks. So that was a lesson I learned. What was shocking in 2007, 2008, right before the Lehman crisis, I remember going to the Fed and talking to Bill Dudley at the time and was like, dude, I lived through this in Asia. What triggered the Asian financial crisis, really the second leg of it, was an investment bank called Peregrine going bankrupt. Peregrine was the rising star of investment banks in Asia, the only local bank that would compete with Goldman Sachs and Mitsubishi and Morgan Stanley. And I remember there was some thought of, if you went to the and declared bankruptcy on a Friday at 6 o'clock and spent the whole weekend reattributing their swap books and their forward currency books, kind of zeroing out the positions, you'd have a lot less market impact than if you just let the hammer fall on Monday morning and everyone executing their rights under the ISDA agreements to unwind risk at any price they can. And I remember talking to Dudley about that. I was like, don't let Lehman go bankrupt uncontrollably. Call everyone on the weekend, look at their swap books, neutralize as much. Someone's long and someone's short. The bank's not carrying that much risk. And they didn't. And you saw what happened. One of the lessons learned from that now is this authority of the central bank to do just that, to shut things down in an orderly manner, to take over. And so I don't think we'll have those ugly deleveragings from financial institutions in the future, because we now have a fire break there. The deleveraging we had with COVID wasn't financial institutions, it was everyone else. It was risk just all getting unwound. And it got unwound so fast, partly because the central bank gave people liquidity to sell into. So even though prices moved a lot, there was liquidity at all those prices. In 08, I had a huge hedge fund. There was shit I couldn't sell at any price, just no bid, you know? And so everyone had these side pockets and you had this destruction in markets, but you didn't have people get to neutral. In this crisis, within 2 weeks, you had this massive selling, but you also had central banks providing enough liquidity to banks and anyone else who needed it, that everything that needed to be sold got sold. And so people got to risk neutral so much faster. They got to the safe island so much faster in this crisis than they did in 2009. I kind of found that fascinating. And so you had the giant spike in vol, and then it kind of collapsed back. And now we have this liquidity fueled rally, which to some degree I worry sets up for another mess at one point, but positioning still isn't that long and people can afford options because vols come down. So we'll see.
I want to get your take on the Fed's response this time as you've started to go into it. In the pre-crisis period, the great financial crisis that you were mentioning, how do you think it gets to be the case that in 04, 05, 06, early 07, that leverage machine kind of builds up in a way that is clearly set up to self-destruct, and yet implied vol, credit spreads, you know, at all-time lows at the time in early 07?
You have to think about the overlying narrative of 89 to 09. That 20, 30 years was probably the best 20 years, 89 to 09, I'm doing my math wrong. The best 20 years that the planet ever saw. And that sounds like a strange claim. We had faster global GDP growth than almost any time in history. We had trade as a percent of GDP rise as fast as it had in history. We had this idea of the death of the business cycle, right? Remember, they had the meeting at Jackson Hole where people basically said there's a new normal and the business cycle is dead, that every central bank became an inflation and targeting central bank, that globalization as a story, that trade was good, that opening borders were good. It was a capitalist revolution, the end of history. And so in lots of ways, it was the best of times. And when you have a confidence surge because everything is great, China lifted a bill, you know, what are there, 500 million people out of poverty. We lifted more people out of poverty in those 20 years than any 20 years in the history of the planet. There was less people at war in those 20 years than any 20 years in the history of the planet. And so that creates confidence. And the lenders, the confidence, you know, he-men were the U.S. and Europe, U.S. and U.K., quite frankly, because we've been doing this for 200 years. I went to the University of Goldman Sachs. There's the University of Barings Bank or J.P. Morgan or Barclays, right? These institutions that taught people how to take risk. If you think about what was happening, Asia was accumulating all these reserves, but they didn't have to take risks so much. So they were keeping their money in dollars and they were lending them to the United States. I used to call my hedge fund M20. You know, you got M2 and M3 and money velocity. And so we were the great leverage creators because there was all this confidence. And the Mideast and Asia was funneling all that money into the U.S. and London, into the hedge fund industry, into the leverage industry to kind of take more leverage. They were happy with the treasury return because they were selling widget and borrowing money to build more widget machines. They weren't going to speculate on risk. And so in some ways, it's intuitive that the pain of the crises happened in New York and in London and in the hedge fund or the banking space. And it's also kind of intuitive, if you think about it, why people got so carried away. Like, it was a great run. We should have learned after the crash, globalization isn't working for everybody. We didn't really get conscious of that until the kick in the nuts of Brexit and then Trump, where people were like, oh, globalization left the bottom 60% of the West behind. Globalization was great for Vietnam, great for China, great for lots of the developing world, great for wealthy America, great for West Coast and New York City. Shitty for bottom 60% of America and Europe. And now we're in this space where we don't have a global narrative. We're kind of half anti-globalist, but still globalist. We're in a trade war with China. We're in politics went hard right with Trump. Let's make America great again. Let's go backwards. We're pivoting all the way to hard left with AOC and Bernie and that sense of this is not fair. We should pay for everything. And until we get a healing narrative that everyone buys into, we're going to remain in this whipsaw of politics, difficult market environment, difficult social environment. And so this guy, Yuval Hariri, who wrote the book Sapiens, I sat with him after the Trump election, and he said he looked back in history at these times when we lost the narrative, when the globe or the country lost its unifying theme. It could take 30 years to get a new one. And until then, you literally are just windshield washing back and forth between populism on either side. And so it's a scary environment.
It definitely feels like the interaction between politics and markets has been increasing. You know, Brexit in 2016 and this whole geopolitical landscape feels increasingly unsteady. You mentioned that these were the best of times leading into 08, 09 and that things were doing so well. And you know, one of the things that I'm reminded of is just that winning trades are very difficult to walk away from. So trades that bet on stability get bigger and bigger and bigger because you kind of restack back into them, even if they're at skinnier prices or smaller margins of error. And so as we think about now, and you've got the lowest rates effectively in history, you've got the government issuing more paper than ever, real rates on the 10-year are, I don't know, minus almost 100 basis points. Doesn't seem like a great deal. What are your thoughts these days as you look at the interest rate markets? You mentioned that they're kind of government controlled. How should people think about owning duration these days?
I think they shouldn't. I honestly think stay away from the markets because think about you've got a kid. I don't know how old you are, but let's say you got a kid and he's 12 and you're saying, hey, I'm going to give you $25,000 to invest for when you're 35. So when you've got your young family that you could have grown that into a nest egg. So are we going to put it into bonds? Probably not with negative real rates. It's so hard to think about where you're going to put your money long term. So a lot ends up going into venture bets or trying to predict the future because there are not a lot of great opportunities for in the macro. So you can find companies, the fast food business, if you could have invested in 15 Chick-fil-A franchises, I bought Bojangles, amazing business. There's some amazing businesses out there. But in terms of the big asset allocation, bonds and stocks are wildly expensive. The growth stocks are as expensive as any stocks I've ever seen. Might they all grow into their valuation? Yeah, maybe, but they've got to literally thread a needle six times straight for Tesla to be worth what Tesla's priced at or for Peloton to be a $20 billion company. And so there's no easy place right now. So it's a great macro environment in that if you're a trader and you can kind of ride the bubble and get off it before it crashes. But when you look at rates, there doesn't seem to be anything to do. Steepener makes sense if you believe the U.S. can go to negative rates. They say no, and maybe they'll say yes. But that's still, it's such a low margin of error. And I think in the long run, long end rates can't be where they are. And so if anything, I'd buy puts on the long bond. or I'd wait till it cracks. But right now, that doesn't seem to be a winning strategy.
Listen to Powell, and he's been incredibly specific about not touching rates for a long time, and clearly the market believes him. The puts on the long bond that you just mentioned, or the five-year or the 10-year note, I mean, the vol on that is as low as ever. And so it doesn't seem like it would take much for that trade to actually go your way. Just any blip of inflation, as they talk about wanting to go above target inflation before they even think about anything.
So what's important, I think, is to understand that the possibility of really shitty outcomes is higher. That's not a prediction that we're going to get really shitty outcomes. It's just that the possibility, the probability, the dollar losing its reserve currency status quicker than we thought is higher. Something going wrong when debt to GDP gets to 150 or 170%, whatever number, there is some threshold out there where the demons live. They call it the Minsky moment in economics. I remember in the movie The Right Stuff when he's driving the plane so fast, and he was like, out here, past the first time they're going through the Mach 1 through 680 miles an hour, whatever Mach 1 is, that's where the demons are. Like, we don't know, because no one thought oil could go to negative $35. And so when you're doing these kind of experiments, and what Powell and the rest of central bank governors are doing is an experiment with pumping in this kind of liquidity. They're buying more bonds per week than they were in QE1. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it's shocking, the intervention going on right now in governments. We don't know how this is going to turn out. And so you want to be long fat tails. Even if you don't put them in your portfolio, your psychology needs to be long fat tails. So when you see something cracking, you don't think, oh, what's happening? You've already game theoried it out. You were like, oh, if we start seeing a breakdown of confidence, it's going to go a long way and I got to get on that trade. Excuse the cursing. Like, I always, because I don't sleep as well as I should, I always fantasize about, man, wouldn't it be great if I sold this and it fell 100 points? But that kind of ballet of what could happen has to be different than it was before COVID, because we're doing things to markets that we've never done before.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about the central banks coming in so forcefully this time. And I just was looking at, in the great financial crisis, the VIX was above 30 for 8 straight months. And they've already got it around 25 just with the force of what they've done. We're taught in markets that there's no free lunch. You just can't get something for free. From the intervention side, as you said, they did stabilize things. So that's good. They prevented a self-reinforcing complete meltdown. What are the side effects that should worry us from your standpoint?
Well, if I was my kid or my grandkid that I don't have yet, I'd be like, F you to you guys for running up all this debt on us. Like, at one point, we're building a debt bubble, global debt bubble, not just the U.S. debt bubble, that someone has to pay back, or you got to inflate away. And so one of the reasons I like Bitcoin and I like gold and silver and other hard assets and even real estate in the Hamptons is that when you just keep pouring out helicopter money, the value of other stuff goes higher. We're going to debase the dollar. The only way out of this is the debasement of the dollar. Now, it's also the debasement of the euro and the yen. And so it's hard to understand what to own the dollar against, or be short the dollar against. But that's why I like gold and Bitcoin as kind of scarce assets. Right? There are only 21 million Bitcoin that will ever be mined. You can take all the gold that's ever been mined in the history of the universe and it fits in a 23-meter cube. So there's a scarcity there, as opposed to, hey, let's just print more dollars. But I think that's the thing you got to watch. Like, when does that psychology click in? When do people say enough's enough? And it's happening, right? Gold's on the highs. It's going to take out the 1925 that we saw in 2011 or 12. And once it takes out the highs, who knows where it goes? 4,000 seems like a good enough bet. 5,000, Bitcoin gets to 20,000 in a year. Certainly it could. Could it get much higher after that? Certainly. If the psychology shifts, if people get worried about central banks becoming, well, they're not going to become Venezuela overnight, but you got where we are and you got Weimar Germany and Venezuela, and you know what it takes to get there. And again, the possibility of that happening is higher than it was. It's not the base case. And so buying these other things as a little bit of a hedge, and then as they grow, they pick up their own momentum. It's going to be hard to get the genie back in the bottle. I think Biden's going to come in and say, I'm going to cut spending and raise taxes and balance this budget. In a weak economy, absolutely no chance.
You mentioned gold in 2012. That was the sovereign crisis. Also, in some ways, kind of a starting point for Bitcoin in terms of getting sponsorship seems to have been that event in Cyprus where bank accounts just got crammed down. When you step back and look at gold and its sort of potential to spiral, and then we can move to Bitcoin. I know you're working on that in just many, many different ways. How should folks think about the behavior of gold? Do you think about it as a hedge against debasement? Is it an inflation hedge? People have different views on it.
I think it's two things. It's a debasement hedge, and it's a political instability hedge. I mean, there is this is bizarre that I'm saying this, but there is a greater than 10%, 5% chance that we have a contested presidential election, that Biden wins and Trump says, no, there was too much mail-in voting in these four states. And he appoints his lapdog Barr, who says, I'm going to do an investigation. And then investigation takes longer than December 11th, when the Electoral College is supposed to meet, and those states don't count. And then Trump has more votes because it's just taken four states that allegedly went to Biden. Like, again, that's not a base case. I think base case is Biden's going to smoke Trump, but that's a possibility. In that case, gold's going higher, like political instability. And we've got those stories in lots of countries. We've got a dictator now in China. Putin said, I'm going to be here till 2038. And there's protests all over the place. Europe is fragile. When Merkel leaves, you're going to see the Nazi party, the far right party, actually get seats in the parliament for the first time in a long time. It's a scary world because we don't have that core theme that's tying us together like we did when we had globalization. And so I think gold works in all those environments, and it works in the inflation, i.e. we're going to debase our currency environment.
What I've seen with gold is it's got a kind of a modest negative correlation to the S&P. Sometimes it's positive correlation, but for the most part, it's a little negatively correlated, but it's certainly correlated to this concept of debasement, as you said. And you point to just political instability in the markets. And when you think about the election, not to predict outcomes at all, but what should we be looking for in terms of the sorts of things that might upend markets? There's definitely talk that just from a corporate tax standpoint, the market ought to be worried about Biden.
Well, Biden is going to try to raise corporate taxes. He's going to raise personal income taxes on the top 5% back to 39.6. But more importantly, he's going to raise the capital gains tax, ordinary income tax. But if you think about like rich guys getting richer versus a common man, all my income comes in capital gains, or not all of it, but a good chunk of it does. I buy a stock, I hold it for a few years, I sell it, or I start a company like Fortress. Fortress, all our income was cap gains. Started a company, we profited in stocks and we sold them. Or dividends, which also had a lower tax rate. And so people are starting to say that's not fair. And so that tax is going to go higher. And that's terrible for the market. You got a big profit in Peloton, and you can either sell it this year with a 20% capital gain or sell it next year at 40%. 20% is a lot. You'll probably sell. And so I think the moment people get around thinking about the election and this kind of bubble mentality that we're in, right? Because we're in a liquidity bubble right now. I mean, shares of Tesla or Zoom or Peloton or any of these high flyers are no different than Bitcoin in 2017. People aren't trading the stock. They're trading a thing. An idea. It's not discounted cash flow models. It's just euphoria. And that's why on a day like today, you can see tech stocks up 6, 8, 9%. I mean, nothing happens. Nothing. Just the market's got the bit between the teeth. We're in a freaking bull market. We're in a bubble. And so in the growth side of the market, we are in irrational exuberance. And it can go a long way. You're supposed to stay on the train, but be on the seat closest to the exit. And I keep trying to short every once in a while, and I burn my hand, and I'm like, feel stupid. I didn't make nearly as much as I would have made this year if I had just stayed long and let it ride. But I do know that space is detached from reality, just like all bubbles get. And what's interesting is all bubbles happen usually around ideas that change the world. The internet bubble in 99, the internet changed everything we do in the world, how we date, how we vote, how we watch movies, even bury people, how we have conference calls. Everything changed with the internet, and more so than we even predicted in 99. But remember, we got to prices in 99, 6,000 on the NASDAQ, which we revisited this year. Like, that's 20 years later. So you can go so far ahead of yourself in a bubble, but mostly because the story is right. The crypto bubble, Bitcoin and blockchain is going to change the world. Bitcoin's not going away, and you will see blockchain systems, some public, most private, in almost every database on the planet in the next 20 years. They'll be ubiquitous. Yeah, that's why there was a bubble. It was an easy story to tell. And right now, this COVID thing has accelerated digitalization and this tech love. And so we're in this liquidity-driven bubble in these stocks. We are going to have electric cars. We are going to have batteries. Is Tesla going to beat everyone all the time, incessantly? Maybe. And maybe they'll grow into their valuation. But the huge possibility is that there are actually other competitors and that they go left when they should go right at least once. That's the way the world works. And so when you're pricing in beyond perfection, you got to be very careful.
I'm reminded of that, came across this old George Soros quote. He said, when I see a bubble forming, I rush to buy it.
100%.
So this is interesting, especially in tech. And then I'd love to just, because you've done so much in Bitcoin, but one of the things we observe on the option side is this almost positive reinforcement between stocks like Tesla as they rise, so does the implied vol, which that was a characteristic of the tech bubble originally in 99 and 2000 that to me was symptomatic of something that was becoming more and more speculative. Bitcoin had this dramatically at the end of 17, that spiral to, what was it, 19,000 or so?
19.9.
And now what's interesting is the vol has come down a tremendous amount. I think the 10-day realized vol is like 9%.
So in 2017, we had not just a Bitcoin bubble, we had a crypto bubble. Matter of fact, the crazier prices were all the non-Bitcoin. Bitcoin was 50% of the price. The rest of crypto is like 5% of where it was, 10% of where it was. Most of the altcoins went down 99%. It was a lot like the 99 tech bubble when all those companies never came back, but the big one did, if it was Amazon or Google. And now we're not in a crypto bubble anymore. We're in an adoption cycle. Bitcoin is slowly being adopted by new players. You saw Paul Tudor Jones put it in his hedge fund. Fidelity is doing custody in it as of the New York Stock Exchange. More institutions are slowly getting into it. It's still a retail product. It's still mostly driven by speculators in Asia and retail. But Bitcoin's owned by over 100 million different people. It is the single biggest distributed security in the history of the planet. It's owned in every country. And every year, more people are being introduced to it. And it's being easier to buy. And so I'm bullish Bitcoin, not in the bubble sense, but on the adoption sense. The macro tailwinds are there with money printing. That's not going away. And so it's a hard asset. It's kind of already established itself as a hard asset. It's a finished product. All the other crypto blockchains are years away from really being at the finished cycle. Ethereum needs to switch from Ethereum 1 to Ethereum 2. And it's a wonderful project. It's still a venture bet. Where Bitcoin's finished, Bitcoin's gold. Now it's just adoption. And I think we're going to see it. And so I don't think it's going to explode, but I just know the money market chart.
On a previous interview you had done, you said, as a social construct, we believe it has value, and so it does. I'd love for you to explain that a little bit more.
Most things that we participate in, we use a discounted cash flow model. We're going to buy Tesla because we think they're going to sell this many cars and this many batteries over the next 10 years or 15 years, and we're going to make X money on each car and battery, and that's going to add up to more than the stock price, right? Pretty much that's the way stocks get priced. We use copper is worth something because we know what it costs to take out of the ground and we know what it's used for. We use copper in all kinds of things, from the gutters in our house to cars, all these industrial use cases. Gold, we don't use for anything. We store it either in jewelry or in vaults. It's value just because people said it was 3,000 years ago. This was where we're going to hold value. And it's only valuable because of the social construct, because lots of people say it's valuable. Think how stupid this would feel. There's a block of gold in the middle of Central Park, that's 23 meters. 23 meters isn't that big, 60 feet aside. It would look small in the middle of one of the big parks, as like a sculpture. And someone said, hey, I made the gold sculpture. And then I say, oh, it's worth $10 trillion. And you shit your pants. $10 trillion? No billion? No trillion. Oh, it's the most expensive piece of art ever. $10 trillion. Like, that makes no sense. It's only valuable because people say it is. Bitcoin's now worth $200 billion because people say it is. It's just a piece of code. We could take the Bitcoin code, relaunch it tomorrow as NovoCoin with the exact same code, get all my friends to try to participate in mine, and it would be worth zero. And so it's not the technology. It's the social system that's been created. And so that's kind of cool. Very few assets that can have value without having utility. The utility is being valuable. Almost everything else we have to use. Even Ethereum got value because we're going to use Ethereum. It's going to be this base level trust where people build databases on top of.
It's fascinating in how it's almost an asset with a psychological underpinning, just like gold. It does have utility that's increasing. And I know your firm, Galaxy Digital, is trading and doing some asset management projects, but you're also doing some venture in the ecosystem of cryptocurrency. I'd love to learn a little bit more about the kind of parts of the value chain that you think are really interesting or maybe underserved where you've gotten involved.
The stablecoin business think about right now, I could send you a picture of me lying on my couch in my cool shorts right here, and it's a bazillion pixels by a zillion pixels, and you'll get it in a half a second, and I can send it over WhatsApp or text or any of these other systems. Pretty easy. But I can't send you money very easily. And if you're sitting in Australia, it's even harder. And so that makes no sense. We are going to have a digitalized money globally, domestically and globally soon. And there are already some digital monies like Venmo and some other apps, but they're centralized. And I honestly believe we're going to have a quasi-decentralized, i.e. a crypto dollar. And you're starting to see it with stablecoins. So Tether is now over 10 million, 9 billion. USDC, which is the U.S. version, which is a lot more regulated and kind of cleaner, is growing leaps and bounds. And it's really easy. I can send it to you. It doesn't cost me anything. Or even Bitcoin. I can send you $500,000 of Bitcoin. It will cost me 11 cents. But you're like, what? If you go to the bank and you're a poor guy and you take out 20 bucks from your ATM and they charge you 250 on top of it, they've charged over 10% to take out 20 bucks. I mean, that's highway robbery. So the transaction cost around moving money are bizarrely high for a place as sophisticated as the U.S. And the poorer you are, the more you get screwed. If it's remittance payments back to the Philippines or to Mexico, or if it's just ATMs or check cashing businesses, all that's going to go digital in the next 5 to 10 years or 3 to 10 years. And so we're investing in that kind of infrastructure. That's also going to drive the price of Bitcoin. So Facebook's big project Libra is nothing more than a stable coin. It's a dollar-based crypto or a euro-based crypto. They'll have 5 different currencies. And so what's happening to your friend's money? Hey, lend me 40 bucks, boom. And it'll be the dollar. But that same platform, their wallet, the Novi wallet, is going to allow you to then, I want to buy some Bitcoin. And so it'll be easier access to Bitcoin. All the rails that people are using to trade Bitcoin, they'll be using to trade those cryptos. So what do you think foreign exchange gets traded when half of it is crypto foreign exchange, even though it's still the dollar or the sterling, which means Goldman Sachs and Barclays and Deutsche, they're all going to have to set up crypto desks or have the capacity sometime in the next 10 years. I don't know. When I know one thing, we're digitalizing everything, and crypto is a better way to digitalize. And so my own guess is this whole space is just going to keep growing. And so one of our venture themes is invest in custody, invest in the exchanges, invest in security, the security companies that track this shit. Invest in the infrastructure of that space. Another theme is the video gaming space is booming. And there is a link to blockchain in there, wildly strong yet, but it's growing. And so a lot of these guys want to build their games on private blockchain spaces so you can have ownership of your avatar, your character, his goods that you create. People are spending more and more time living in the virtual world, playing video games, or just being virtual beings. And so I would have ownership of that and not have the game producer own everything. And so there are tons and tons of applications. Every company is now looking at blockchain supply chains to prove authenticity, to prove provenance of where things have come from. Lastly, I'll leave you with digital goods, fractionalized shares, fractionalized art, fractionalized automobiles, new digital objects that you can sell. There's a company called Wax, and they've done, remember the old Garbage Pail Kids from when we were kids? They've got virtual Garbage Pail Kids, and there's even a Mike Novo Wax. Looks like one of the old cartoons. And you can buy those things and trade them like they were baseball cards, but now they're digitalized. And so I think the world is shifting faster than we think.
Yeah, it does seem like the COVID crisis is just an accelerant in so many social trends and economic trends that were already in place are probably moving more quickly as a result. And one of them is in the realm of inequality. And of course, we've had a tough summer around the world and certainly in the U.S. on that front. You've done some great work. I would love for you to just describe your interest in creating the Bail Project, what you and your team are setting out to do there. It looks like some great work, and it'd be great to learn more about it.
Sure. So listen, crypto itself, I got excited about it because it was about systems change. It was like, how can you create a better architecture for the world that's more just, that's more equitable? Like, that's the core of the crypto DNA. When you talk to the guys who built Ethereum or the original Bitcoin OGs, like, how do we do something that's more trustworthy and more, that we don't need to trust one person? Governments by definition are political. So how can we have something sovereign outside of government? Bitcoin is its own government. And so along the same speed, the criminal justice reform movement, Black Lives Matter, all these protests recently are about injustice. It's about systems change. And so it lines up, quite frankly, with crypto. It's not just about racial inequality, though that's the driving force in front of us right now, but it's about economic inequality, healthcare inequality, gender inequality. And so there's this kind of revolutionary zeal that I think has come from the fact that capitalism left so many people behind, that the way we were participating in this globalization world literally had Jeff Bezos worth $175 billion, and the average American is not worth much more than they were 25 years ago on a real basis. And so this is kind of the revolution. We started looking at criminal justice mostly because, you know, I made a whole lot of money in Ethereum, and I wanted to kind of do more philanthropy, mostly to make myself feel less guilty when I bought a big private jet. And I gave a big chunk of money to the Bail Project to help take this small thing national. And when I did that, I was smart enough to hire a couple guys to like look at the whole criminal justice space from pretrial all the way to the death penalty, profiteering in prisons, the food in prisons, phone calls, prosecutorial reform, how we got here, the history of it. And the more you dig in, the more outraged you get, the more stupid the system is, the more mean-spirited it is, the more dehumanizing and degrading, debasing it is. And so I now spend about 30% of my time thinking about how do we help fix these issues. I spend a lot of my money funding organizations or trying to find other people to help fund organizations. Bail was a pretty simple one. We have 480,000 people that will go to bed tonight in jail, having been arrested but not convicted, mostly because they're in jail, mostly because they can't afford bail. So if they were my kids, they certainly would be in jail. They'd be waiting their trial with a lawyer. And because they're in jail, they all plead guilty. They're seven times more likely to plead guilty than not guilty because they just want to get home. They want to see their kids. They want to go there and lose their job. When you're stuck in jail for 3 weeks, you lose your job. You sometimes lose your custody of your kids. 40% of prison rape, which is not pleasant, and 40% of prison death happens in the first 30 days someone's in jail, right? They're new. They're in an environment they don't understand. And so it's trauma, and it doesn't have to be that way. There are people that literally sit in jail for 9 months waiting for their trial because they stole a loaf of bread. I was like, just give the guy the bread. One lady that we bailed out literally had stolen diapers. And I was like, didn't anybody think it would be more humane and like smarter just to give the lady diapers? And so you don't believe the system. And, you know, Brian Stevens talked about proximity until you go see it. Like until you go into jail, you can't comprehend how shitty it is that you're, I mean, it's a dehumanizing place. And it doesn't help us all. So it becomes a giant revolving business. Over 5 million people will go to jail this year, new people. We have 2.3 million people in jail. We have 4.5 million people on supervision, i.e. parole or probation. If I was in charge, there'd be zero on parole or probation. It does nothing good for those people. You'd give them some rehabilitation help, some job training, some how do I integrate that person back into society to make them a taxpayer. Anyway, you hit my soft button here. The positive note is I think George Floyd has woken people up to the fact that yeah, those people that were screaming for the last 25 years, they were right. Colin Kaepernick was right, and we need to do something about it. And I think people are more willing to do something about it today than they have been in the last 15 years. And so I'm hoping we see a lot of change. We've seen a lot of money move into the field. There are a lot of talented activists in the field. I had a dinner last night at my house, and these are fellows that we sponsor. One of the guys is trying to get rid of solitary, or at least cap solitary at 15 days. So one of the guys had been in jail for 15 years, one had been in for 38 years, and we're having dinner. And if you've been in for 38 years, you've murdered somebody or done something really horrible. And this man could not have been more graceful and more nice and more gentle. And he had come to grips with what he had done years ago and had made his amends and trying to live a productive life. I asked them, how many people in jail spend time in solitary? You know what the answer was? All of them. Anybody who spends more than 2 years in jail is going to have spent some time in solitary. The UN says after 15 days, you shouldn't be in solitary. It's torture. This guy spent 8 straight months in solitary without a break, the shoe. 18 months. And I'm thinking to myself, what in God's name, kind of system that we have that we're locking a guy in a box for 18 months. And so that would be my like last pitch. People that get interested in, get a little proximity. Go visit the local jail. And it will shift your thinking. Anyway, sorry for such a long answer.
Yeah, congrats to you, not just on being a financial supporter, but actually really getting involved and starting this. We need more folks to take a stand. So as we wrap up, and I want to thank you very much for your time, here's a question I'd love for you to just entertain. So suppose the VIX has got all the way back down to 25. Suppose it got back to 50. What do you think went wrong? What are the risks that we might not fully appreciate right now?
Point, I think you'll see a growth value unwind that could get scary for people, because once that trade gets going, I think retail is really long equities at bad levels, and so you could see a wash. I think a Biden wipeout isn't priced into the market, where the Senate, the House, and the presidency all go to the Dems. Like, what stops the bubble? Central bank action stops a bubble, and we're not going to have central bank action. The other thing that would stop a bubble would be a big tax shift. And so really what probably creates the bubble reversing is the election. And we're a couple months away from that, right? 3.5 months away. So maybe in a month and a half, you put that on your radar. And until then, David, we just keep going up.
Well, we shall see how all this evolves. Mike, this has been a great conversation. Thanks again for your time, and really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.